So this week, I'm very happy to welcome Bill Pfefferman to give the PI Quantum Info seminar. So Bill did his PhD at Caltech and then did postdocs at University of Maryland and Berkeley, and he's now at Chicago. So please take it away.
Okay, great. Oops, hold on. All right, so it's great to be here, at least virtually, to tell you about the power of random quantum circuits. Like you said, I'm Bill Pfefferman from the University of Chicago. This talk is going to be based on two joint works with my Berkeley collaborators. The first is joint with Adam Bolin, Chinmay Nerki, and Umesh Vazirani. The second, much more recently, is joint with Adam Bolin, Zef Landau, and Yunxiao Liu. And just appeared at this last QIP. Okay, so the starting point for this talk, which I think by this point will not be a surprise for most people in the audience, is that we've now seen the first sort of quantum supremacy claims. And in fact, we've seen two of these claims. The first in late 2019 by Google in a sort of superconducting qubit setup that they call random circuit sampling. And then a second claimed quantum supremacy demonstration was made by a group out of Shanghai by USTC, actually reasonably recently in late 2020, using what they called the Gaussian boson sampling proposal. To cut to the chase, in this talk, I want to give the latest sort of formal complexity theoretic evidence to believe that these experiments might be solving hard problems for classical computers. Right, so we're not going to solve sort of all the problems, but I want to sort of tell you the progress we've made in the last few years. From a physical point of view, these experiments are of course quite different. Quite different. They're in completely different quantum architectures. That is, roughly speaking, what constitutes a qubit or what constitutes a gate is entirely different. They have a similar theoretical framework, right? Which is they both solve sort of random quantum circuit sampling tasks. In other words, the hard problem that these quantum experiments are solving is to sample from the output distribution of a randomly chosen quantum circuit. Right? So the sort of initial theory goal that as a community we have not yet reached, but that we've been working toward for the last 10 or more years, is to prove the impossibility of an efficient classical sampler algorithm that essentially simulates an idealized version of these random quantum experiments. Right, more formally, what this should mean is that we're trying to prove that there's no algorithm that takes as input a random quantum circuit with an ideal output distribution that I'll call D sub C. So the circuit is C, the output distribution is D sub C. It's a distribution over n bit strings, and we think of it as the output distribution if we measure all the n qubits in the computational basis after applying the circuit. So that's the input of the algorithm. It's this random circuit C. And the goal, we're sort of challenging our classical sampling algorithm to output a sample from any distribution X that's close in total variation distance to the ideal output distribution of the random circuit D sub C with high probability over the choice of circuit. Okay, graphically, it looks something like this. If the ideal output distribution of the random quantum circuit is D sub C, we're sort of challenging our classical algorithm to output a sample from any distribution that's sort of in this green sort of sub bubble, this ball of epsilon, of radius epsilon, away from the idealized distribution, and we're trying to show that no classical algorithm can solve this problem. Right. Okay, cool. So before I go on, is the goal at least clear? And of course, I haven't formalized what I mean by things like a random quantum circuit. What is the distribution over circuits? But I think other than that, the goal should be reasonably clear. So any questions before I continue? Okay, great. So, you know, before I sort of delve into the details of a hardness proof, you know, we should maybe first say why random quantum circuits are attractive from the perspective of near-term experiments. And, you know, I can think of at least two reasons. One is sort of the obvious one, which is presumably they're sort of experimentally feasible. From my perspective, a more theoretical perspective, this sort of experimental feasibility is wrapped up in the fact that, you know, there's a general optimism in our community that there's hardness for random quantum circuits at comparatively modest quantum resources, like reasonably low depth, or small system size, as compared with, you know, implementing some idealized quantum algorithm from the 90s, like Shor's algorithm or Grover's algorithm. And then I think there are also really important advantages for the verification or benchmarking of random quantum circuits. So for example, you know, the output distribution of Google's ensemble of random quantum circuits have what we call the Porter-Thomas property, which is essentially that for any outcome, any fixed outcome X, the probability over the choice of random circuit that the outcome probability of seeing X when we measure in the standard basis is equal to Q over N is exponentially distributed in minus Q, right? So the probability itself is like E to the minus Q. And you know, we can use this property, the fact that we sort of understand the distribution of the output probabilities of a random circuit to calculate the ideal score of a random circuit on benchmarking tests, right? So Google explicitly uses this property of random circuits to understand what their ideal cross-entropy score should be, right? So they have benchmarking tests for which the sort of only way they can understand what the ideal score on this benchmarking test is sort of to use the special property of random quantum circuits, right? So in my mind, these two things are sort of why random quantum circuits are so interesting from the perspective of near-term experiments. Okay, so again, any questions about this before I go on? Okay, great. So feel free to stop me at any time to ask questions. So now, you know, let's talk about in a little bit more detail what we mean when we say a random quantum circuit. So here we'll sort of standardize on what Google meant in their experiment, but much of the theory that I'll describe would apply to you know, much broader scenarios. So here's what I mean when I mean a random quantum circuit in the context of this talk. We're going to generate a quantum circuit on n qubits that live on a 2D lattice with d, which we think of generally as being around square root n layers of Haar random nearest neighbor gates. So graphically each sort of layer of gates might look something like this. The circles here are qubits, right? The edges are Haar random nearest neighbor 2-qubit gates. And this is, of course, just a single layer of the gates. You know, the next layer could look could look different. Maybe the horizontal neighbors could be connected rather than the vertical neighbors. But the point is, you know, to get our sample from this random circuit, we start in some canonical initial state, like the all zero state. We apply our random circuit, which again corresponds to square root n different such layers, and then we measure all of the n qubits in the computational basis to get our sample. Okay. So this is what I mean when I say a random circuit, quantum circuit. This sort of defines the distribution that I'm going to be referring to, you know, most of the time, unless I specify otherwise. Okay. Okay. Let me just pause briefly for any questions, and then I'll continue. So is it clear what I mean by a random quantum circuit? Okay. Okay, great. All right, so now how do we prove that sampling from the output distribution of this random quantum circuit you know, is a hard problem for any classical algorithm? So our goal is to prove that there does not exist this classical sampling algorithm under standard complexity theory assumptions. The first step is to, that's sort of now standard in the analysis of these proposals, is to try to sort of distance ourselves as much as possible from the sampling problem. So, you know, by well-known reductions, originating in the 80s with a result of Stockmeyer, and first used in the context of analyzing quantum supremacy proposals by Aronson and Arkhipov with respect to the boson sampling proposal. It turns out that if our goal is to show that there does not exist a classical sampling algorithm, it suffices to prove that estimating the output probability of a random quantum circuit is Sharpe-P hard. So it sort of moved from the sampling problem to a computing problem, to trying to compute the output probability of this random quantum circuit. Or graphically, you know, what Stockmeyer's algorithm says is the following: let's suppose, for contradiction, that there does exist a classical sampling algorithm that outputs from, you know, outputs a sample from the you know, outcome distribution of a random quantum circuit. Well, then Stockmeyer's algorithm tells us that there exists another algorithm that sort of computes output probabilities of the random quantum circuit. Now, there's an asterisk here, and the asterisk here is for several reasons. The first one that's very important is that this new algorithm that computes the output probabilities of a random quantum circuit is not your sort of efficient algorithm. It uses an NP oracle, right? So it's a BPP to the NP oracle. Also, what we mean by computing output probabilities here is somewhat non-standard, right? What we mean is sort of giving a particular additive estimate to the output probability of a randomly chosen quantum circuit. We just described the distribution over quantum circuits with high probability. Okay, so the goal is to show that this is a hard problem. Computing the output probability should not be a problem that can be solved by BPP to the NP machines, and therefore that there's no classical sampling algorithm. So we sort of use this backwards, like in sort of as a proof by contradiction, to show that there does not exist a classical algorithm for sampling from the output distribution of a random quantum circuit. Okay, so any questions before I go on here?
Sorry, Bill, you said additive, but I thought it was multiplicative with Stockmeyer. Is that right?
Yeah, that's actually a fantastic question. It's a subtle point. So it is true that Stockmeyer technically gives a constant factor multiplicative estimation, for example, to the output probability of your circuit, or of your classical sampler. But the more important error is an additive error. And the reason for that is because of this total variation distance. If we know that we have two distributions that are close in total variation distance, let's say they're epsilon away, and we choose, what ends up happening is we end up picking a random, a uniform probability to use Stockmeyer's algorithm on, right? Then what we know is that the expected distance between these two probabilities, the ideal probability and the probability that the sampler outputs, is like epsilon over the number of outcomes with high probability. And it turns out the multiplicative error can be folded into the same, additive error of like epsilon, which is the total variation distance, over the number of outcomes. So in fact, while technically speaking, you're absolutely right, the Stockmeyer algorithm itself gives us a multiplicative error. It gives us a multiplicative error to the noisy probability. And the noisy probability itself is within some additive distance away from the, from the ideal distribution. Does that help?
Sure. So it's additive in the total variation distance, rather than the individual probabilities.
Wait, say it again. I think I missed that last point.
It's additive in the total variation distance rather than the individual probabilities.
Well, but it's right. So it's additive epsilon in the total variation distance. That's the assumption, right? But then what I'm saying is that if you then ask, let's say our goal is to pick a uniformly chosen probability, right? Like the probability of seeing, instead of the all zeros outcome, a uniformly chosen Y, which is an n-bit string. And we want to know what is the difference in probability of the ideal quantum circuit outputting Y and the noisy quantum circuit, the distribution, the sampler, the probability that the approximate sampler outputs Y. But with high probability over the choice of Y, that's going to be epsilon over the number of outcomes, right? So in other words, you're absolutely right. The additive error comes from the total variation distance, but you can say most outcomes are also that the probability of most outcomes are also, you know, the total variation distance over the number of outcomes with very high probability. So it's sort of both, right? The error on the probabilities and also the total variation distance. Sorry, does that make sense?
I think so. Thank you for that clarification.
Okay, cool. Any other questions about this? And we'll formalize all this in a minute in case the formal statement is unclear. I just wanted to sort of give this at a high level first. Okay, cool. So let's be a little bit more formal, and maybe this will help address some of your questions. Let's start with a definition. Let's let the output probability of a quantum circuit C be this quantity. It's just, you know, the probability that that if I start in the all zero state, I apply my circuit and then I measure that I see again all zeros, right? So I'm going to call that P0 of C throughout this talk. Then what we're interested in is this sort of average case estimation of this output probability, which I call the delta random circuit estimation problem, which is the following. So we're given as input a quantum circuit C, and we're supposed to output a Q, which is an estimate to the output probability to with an imprecision delta with probability 2/3 over C. Okay. It turns out to prove the goal of hardness of sampling from the output distribution of a random quantum circuit, it suffices to show that this delta equal around 1/2 n problem is sharp P hard. And I sort of said, roughly speaking, why in my answer to the prior, to the sort of previous question, but the reason that this is the important quantity, the right sort of size of delta for the sampling problem, is because this turns out to be the size of a typical output probability of a random quantum circuit that acts on n qubits. It's around 1/2 n. So that's the goal, to show that this sort of 1/2 n random circuit estimation problem is sharp P hard, okay? Now, we can't show this yet. This is has been our goal for the last at least 5 or 6 years, or really since 2011. When Aronson Arkhipov talked about it with respect to boson sampling. But what we can show is sharp P hard for a circuit on n qubits, which throughout this talk I'm going to think of as size m, which is n times d. Right, D is the depth. So the size of the circuit for me is always going to be on the order of n times d. And what we can show, so what we were able to show in 2018 with our first paper on the subject is that this the delta equal 2^-m^3 problem is sharp P hard. What we were able to show very recently in our new paper is that 2^-m log m. Random circuit estimation problem is sharp P hard, but we're still not quite at our goal, right? We think of ourselves as pretty close because for most of what I'll talk about, we can think of the depth of our circuit as constant. So, you know, M is equal to big O of N. And then we're only off by sort of a log N factor in the exponent, right? But of course, we're still not there. Now, it turns out that in the case of boson sampling, essentially the same arguments that we use in our latest paper take us even closer to the goal. With respect to a boson sampling experiment with n photons and n squared mones, which is a particularly important setting of parameters in the boson sampling experiment, what Aronson and Arkhipov were able to show in 2011 is that 1/e^4 was hard. In 2021, now in our new paper, we're able to show 1/e^6 n log n is hard. And the goal here is now 1 over e to the n log n. And the reason that this is different, the goal, the imprecision goal that we're trying for is different in boson sampling and in random circuit sampling, is simply because the size of a typical output probability of a boson sampling experiment is on the order of 1 over e to the n log n. Again, in this setting where we have n modes and n photons and n squared modes. That's the only difference. The techniques are essentially the same, but what we're shooting for is a little bit different. And in fact, we're within a factor of 6 in the exponent to what we need, which seems really close. As a complexity theorist, I'm not used to thinking about constant factors as mattering. But what I'm also going to tell you about is that at least for random circuits, we also think we've hit a barrier having to do with the noise robustness of the techniques we're using. So I'll talk about this more toward the end of my talk. But for now, what I want to get across is that I think it might actually be quite difficult to do sort of any better than we've already done, at least without developing radically new proof techniques. And so I'll explain this. And again, I find that sort of surprising because we're not used to thinking of, in complexity theory, again, we're not used to thinking of like a factor of 6 as really mattering very much. But I think there might be a reason to think it at least for RCS, it does matter. Okay. Okay, cool. So questions before I go on? Okay, great. So let me give you a roadmap for the rest of the talk. So first I want to sort of summarize the proof of our hardness result from my Nature Physics paper in 2018. To do this, I'll first discuss a beautiful argument of Lipton, which proves the average case hardness of computing the permanent of a random matrix over a finite field. And then we'll spend the rest of the discussion adapting Lipton's result from the permanent to the output probability of a random quantum circuit. And then in the second part of the talk, I want to prove that these results are sort of robust in a certain specific sense to uncorrected depolarizing noise. And as I sort of mentioned before, it turns out that we can think of this robustness, the fact that that these techniques are sort of don't really change very much when we consider uncorrected noise, can actually be thought of as giving a barrier against improving our hardness results to larger imprecision delta. Okay, so that shouldn't be at all obvious right now, but it's sort of a surprising consequence of this robustness result is that in fact we think it sort of implies that we won't be able to do much better with the current techniques. Okay, great. So let me now describe, I think a really beautiful proof. It's very simple but very clever. That goes back to the early 90s. Of Dick Lipton, where he shows the average case hardness for computing the permanent of a random matrix over a sufficiently large finite field. So let's just recall that, Valiant showed in the late 70s that computing the permanent of an n by n matrix is sharp p hard in the worst case, right? So the permanent, of course, looks a lot like the determinant, but for reasons we don't quite understand, the determinant turns out to be easy. Right? You can solve it with Gaussian elimination, classically in polynomial time, but the permanent is not only np hard, it's sharp p hard, okay? But the worst case hardness here that Lipton showed, of course, means that, I can't expect to solve the permanent, to compute the permanent of every matrix over, say, over a finite field. To sort of boost this hardness from worst case hardness to average case hardness, we're going to use a very simple algebraic property of the permanent, which is we can think of the permanent as a degree n polynomial in n squared variables, which are our matrix entries. Right? And that's clear just from the way I wrote the permanent here. Okay, and so here's the sort of setting of average case hardness. This is the goal. The goal is to compute the permanent of your favorite matrix X, which is some arbitrary matrix. I'll call it the worst case matrix, right, over our field. But we only have assumed access to an algorithm O that is sort of a faulty algorithm. It only works to correctly compute most permanence over our finite field. So the permanent of most matrices over FP. In other words, this is what O does. We give it as input a random matrix Y, and we're guaranteed that O, you know, correctly computes the permanent of Y with high probability over the choice of Y. Okay. And now the setting is we want to somehow cleverly use this faulty algorithm O, right, that doesn't always work, to correctly compute the permanent of your favorite worst case matrix X. Okay. So what does Lipton do to do this? Well, it turns out it's a very simple and again quick argument that's I like quite a bit. It's one of my favorite proofs. Let me share it with you. So what he does is he chooses n plus one fixed non-zero points in his finite field. Let's call them T1, T2 through Tn plus one, and then a uniformly random matrix R over our field. Okay. And now we consider the line A of t, which is equal to x plus t times r. Okay, so we're just taking our worst case matrix that we want, x, which we want to know the permanent of, and we're shifting it by t times r. Okay. And now there's sort of two observations about this line. And once we get through these observations, the proof will essentially spell itself out. So the first one is what I call the marginal property, which says for each I, A of T sub I is a random matrix, a uniformly random matrix over FP. This is not hard to see, right? It's just because what did we do? We took a fixed matrix X and we shifted it by something random. And so this is a uniformly random matrix, right, for every I. And then the second observation is that there's a sort of univariate polynomial property here, which is that the permanent of A of T is a degree N polynomial in the single variable T. And that's also not hard to see. This is a direct consequence of this algebraic property of the permanent, which is that the permanent itself is a degree N polynomial in the N squared variables. Right? So now permanent of A of T is a degree N polynomial in the single variable T. Right, so this essentially tells us what we're going to do. The way the Lipton's argument works is it sort of takes these n plus one points, right? Each one, of course, corresponding to the permanent of some random but sort of jointly correlated matrices, right? And they by the fundamental theorem of algebra, because this is a degree n polynomial in a single variable t, these n plus one evaluation points uniquely define the polynomial permanent of A of t. And so we can use error correction. Really, you can think about it as like noisy polynomial extrapolation methods to recover from these n plus one evaluation points the coefficients of the polynomial permanent of A of t. And once we do that, it's trivial to get the permanent of x, our worst case matrix, by simply setting t equals zero. By evaluating this recovered polynomial at t equals zero, because when t is equal to zero, well, a of zero is equal to x, and so the permanent of a of zero is equal to the permanent of x. Okay, so this is a very, I think, a very slick proof. I'm happy to take sort of any questions before we go on to the next step, which is to try to sort of adapt this proof in the random circuit sample in the random circuit setting. So any questions about how this proof works?
Could you say a bit about how the error correction works?
Yeah. Let me try to say why this is, in the case that I've described, it's actually very, very simple. Error correction, super advanced error correction techniques are not needed. So why is that? Let's say this is, so remember the success probability of this, this algorithm O is 1 minus 1 over poly. I think we only need it to be, for the argument I'm about to describe, I think we only need it to be something like 1 minus 1 over, something like n plus 1, right? And then what we have is by sort of a union bound, right, with high probability, over our choice of points and so on. In fact, this O is going to get these n plus 1 points all correct. Right, and once we have that, we're done. right? So the only place that sort of advanced error correction turns out to be needed is if we're interested in a setting in which this probability is a lot smaller than 1 - 1/(n+1) or something like that. So we can't use a union bound to say with high probability all of these n+1 points are correct. And in fact, you know, and so describing these techniques are sort of a little bit, out of the scope of this talk. But what I'll say is there's some really interesting results out there. So, you know, a classic result in this, in sort of the theory of average case hardness of the permanent is that, in fact, the permanent is not only hard if O succeeds with probability 1 - 1/Pauli, like I just said, in which a union bound shows everything. But even if this succeeds with if O succeeds with probability 1/Pauli, so not 1 - 1/Pauli, but 1/Pauli, and that uses essentially list decoding techniques, which are quite advanced. It's a famous result of Madhu Sudan and others. But again, a classical error correction, right? Not quantum error correction. But I think I guess what I want to say is in this setting that I quoted here, where you have a probability of success of 1 - 1/Pauli, you actually don't need sort of fancy error correction techniques. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Thanks.
Sure. That's a great question. Anyone else before I go on?
Is this for exactly computing the permanent, or also for approximating the permanent? This proof
great.
Here.
Yeah. Okay, that's a great question. So far, everything here has been finite fields. There's no real natural setting that I've sort of introduced yet of sort of approximation. Of course, when we talk about the quantum circuit case, we're going to be talking about the complex numbers, and we're going to have to be very careful about approximations. But so far, everything I've said here, you should think of it as exact.
Right. So it's like, I guess I'm confused whether the last part where you can do this extrapolation, how the error will propagate in that case, if you have an approximation error.
Right. Exactly. So we'll get exactly there. Like this is okay. Going to be sort of the upshot of the talk.
All right. Thanks.
But absolutely. So far though, this is everything is over finite fields and exact.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. So now let's try to describe how we can adapt this proof from the permanent of a random matrix to the output probability of a random quantum circuit. The first observation is just like the permanent, there's sort of an algebraic property here, which is the output probability of a random quantum circuit sort of has a low degree polynomial structure. And low, I mean, in sort of relative terms, it's like lower than what it could potentially be. And to see that, we can let's consider taking our circuit, breaking it apart into its gates. So let's say C is equal to CM times CM minus one, and so on. Maybe these are all 2-qubit gates, so that doesn't matter so much. And then the polynomial structure comes from the Feynman path integral, which allows us to write this output amplitude, right, as this giant sum over paths, right? Well, there's an exponential number of paths. But the key point is that the value of each path, is manageable. It's the product of m gate entries of the circuit, right? So, this is a polynomial of degree m. M, remember, is the size of the circuit in the gate entries of the circuit. Okay, and then of course by the Born rule, the output probability turns out to be a polynomial of degree 2m. Right, you just square the probability. Okay. So now, how can we sort of try to use this structure, this polynomial structure that's evident here, to try to copy Lipton's proof? Okay, well, the first attempt we're going to do will fail. But let me just remind you what the setting is. It's the same setting that we had before. We want to compute the output probability for our worst case circuit, so P0 of C for your favorite C that you give me. Right, but we only have the ability to compute the output probabilities of most randomly chosen circuits from a distribution like the one I described earlier when I talked about Google's experiment. And so recall Lipton, wanted to do this. He wanted to compute the permanent of X. So we chose a random matrix R and then considered this line A of T equal X plus T times R. Okay. But if we just do this sort of dumb thing and try to copy this, it doesn't work, right? It doesn't work for sort of obvious reasons. The we can't just perturb our gates in a random linear direction. If C is unitary, D is some other unitary. Well, C plus T times D is not generally unitary, right? So that sort of obvious strategy doesn't seem to work. So what we need is sort of a new approach to scrambling the gates of a fixed, you know, worst case quantum circuit. So let me try to give you another way of doing this. This will still not work, but it will be closer to what we eventually settle on. So let's suppose we choose and fix M par random gates, which I call HI. So that's H1, H2 through HM. Okay, so one per each gate in our ideal quantum circuit C. And now we're going to consider a new scrambled circuit, which I'll call C prime, so that for each gate in the scrambled circuit, C prime sub I, it's equal to Ci times Hi, right? The ith gate in our ideal circuit times the Haar random two-qubit gate. So notice that by the sort of invariance property of the Haar measure, you know, each gate in C prime is totally scrambled, right? It's Haar random, sort of an analog of Lipton's marginal property that, you know, we started with some fixed circuit, we did something to it, which then sort of scrambles it and gives it, you know, gives us something random. The problem is that in some ways we've scrambled too well, right? There's sort of no univariate polynomial structure that kind of connects our worst case circuit C with the scrambled circuit C prime. It's just totally random. It's not clear at all how to do something clever to extract the output probability of C from the output probability of the scrambled circuit C prime. Okay, so we're going to need to try a little harder. And so to do that, we're going to sort of correlate via what I call quantumness. So what we need is the analog to Lipton's univariate polynomial structure, which in some sense allowed him to extract structure out of randomness, right? And so the main idea for doing this is going to be to implement a tiny fraction of the inverse of these Haar random two-qubit gates, HI inverse. So let's consider a different way of scrambling our circuit. It's not going to scramble quite as well, but it's almost as good. So each gate of the scrambled circuit, Ci prime, is going to be the ith gate of the ideal circuit, Ci, times Hi. It's the same thing as last time. So now we've completely scrambled, right? Times this the theta sort of root of this Hi inverse. So times e to the minus I, little Hi theta, where little Hi is the log of big Hi. Right. So now notice this sort of has a Lipton-like structure to it. So what do I mean by that? Well, you know, if theta is equal to one, then notice that all we've done is, you know, implemented the full inverse of each Hi. Right. And so that sort of these two cancel, the Hi times Hi inverse, and we're just left with, you know, each gate in the scrambled circuit equals Ci, which means that the circuit C prime is equal to C. Okay, but notice that if we take theta really tiny, right, then each gate is really close to Haar random, right? Because we've essentially implemented, essentially nothing, right? And we should be very close to Ci times Hi, which is random. Okay. So, you know, the proof strategy, which is going to fail, but it's going to fail for sort of, you know, not very interesting reason. You know, it's very close, is that what you can hope to do is sort of take several non-zero but small theta, like maybe, you know, remember it's a degree 2m polynomial, so let's say 2m plus one different thetas that are pretty small. You know, for each one, we get a corresponding random but sort of correlated scrambled circuit, right? And then we can hope to sort of use the assumed ability to calculate the output probability of a random circuit to sort of apply a polynomial extrapolation trick to extract, this polynomial in theta, and then evaluate theta at one, which gives us back the output probability of our worst case quantum circuit. Well, that's going to be the strategy, but it turns out it's not quite right. And it's not quite right for a pretty simple reason, which is that, you know, e to the minus I Hi theta is not a fixed degree polynomial in theta, right? It's not a super deep statement. And so the solution that we proposed, which does turn out to work, but which is a bit subtle, is to take the fixed truncation of the Taylor series for e to the minus I hi theta. So in other words, here's the final way we propose sort of scrambling our circuit. The ith gate of the scrambled circuit Ci prime is Ci times Hi. Now, instead of e to the minus I Hi theta, it's going to be the fixed order Taylor series truncation of this thetath root of Hi inverse. Okay, so now notice that each gate entry is a polynomial in theta because the Taylor series is a polynomial in theta, right? And so by the Feynman path integral, so is the output probability of C prime, this sort of truncated circuit. Okay, so now we really can sort of use the Lipton method that I just described directly. We can interpolate and, or I should say extrapolate and sort of recover this polynomial in theta and then evaluate it at theta equal one, which as we agreed earlier, gives us back the output probability of our worst case quantum circuit. Okay, cool. So that's what we propose. Any questions about this? There are definitely some subtleties here, but I'll sort of stop for questions first. Okay, great. So if there's no questions, let me keep going. I think that the main sort of technical question that we address in our 2018 work is how do we motivate these sort of Taylor series truncations? In particular, notice that the distribution we just defined over truncated circuits is not even unitary exactly, right? It's very, very close to unitary. But it's not exactly unitary. And so, the rest of the paper, after we outline the strategy, we really spend trying to motivate why it should be relevant to consider this new distribution over circuits that's not even really supported over unitaries, right? But the point we try to make is that if you recall back to the beginning, our goal is not to prove the hardness of exactly computing the output probability of C, but rather in computing an estimate. Right, this additive 1/2 to the n estimate to P0 of C. And so our result is proving the hardness of computing the output probability of a slightly non-unitary truncated circuit, C prime, so that the output probability P0 of C prime is extremely close to P0 of C. Right, we have the freedom to make the truncation parameter as large as we want. So we can get it like exponentially close. And so the main result that we showed in our paper, I see this as sort of the main technical result, is that in fact, if our goal is to produce this estimation, right, then in fact, estimating the output probability of this truncated quantum circuit, right, is hard if and only if estimating the output probability of the unitary quantum circuit is hard. Right, and this is sort of an intuitive statement. It's because this truncation error that we sort of incur by truncating the Taylor series of this unitary at some fixed order is just so much smaller than the size of the additive error where conjecturing is hard. Right, and so this is sort of my graphical way of showing this. If this is the output probability of our unitary quantum circuit C, right, that's a random circuit. This is the output probability of our sort of truncated circuit. We're sort of conjecturing that any outputting any quantity in this sort of wide interval, comparatively wide interval of width 2^-n over poly, is hard. Right. And so, if we're really making that conjecture, then it shouldn't really matter if we're sort of talking about this quantity that's only an inverse exponential, 2^n over some exponential away. Right. So that's the sort of intuition. We can actually formalize that in fact, with respect to this estimation, which we need to make anyway to talk about hardness of sampling, it just simply doesn't matter if we're talking about the hardness of the truncated circuit or the hardness of the unitary circuit. But proving that is actually reasonably technical, and it uses special properties of the distribution of over these truncated circuits. Okay, sorry. Any questions before I continue?
Yeah, can I just ask, when you're talking about this inverse exponential, is that in the degree of the truncation, or what is the degree of truncation coming to it?
What is the degree? Yes, the degree of, sorry. So this is, when I say this inverse exponential, I really mean like 2^-n for an arbitrary polynomial, right? And what I'm saying is by choosing, by setting the, you know, the Taylor series truncation parameter, let's call it K, sufficiently large, you know, sufficiently large polynomial, you can make, you can drop this error to be, you know, a arbitrary exponentially small quantity. So that's sort of what I mean. So of course there's like a dependency between K and this, this two to the minus poly that I'm sort of not fully spelling out, but that's sort of the idea. And I think that should be sort of intuitive by the sort of convergence property of the Taylor series. Good question though. Anyone else? Cool. So let me keep going. So what's nice is in recent follow-up work, you know, in fact, hardness has been shown around the original output probability. So this is a series of works, of follow-up works by Rami Smobasag, and you know what he does is prove formally that computing the output probability of the original random circuit C is hard to within the same sort of 2^-n³, or I guess m³ approximation. Right. And so again, here's the sort of modified picture. Now, you know, the sort of dash of hardness, this red dash of hardness just moved a little bit from the truncated quantum circuit to the output probability of the actual, you know, unitary quantum circuit C. So you know, just to be clear, if we're talking about hardness of sampling and we're going to make this conjecture that it's hard to output anything in this sort of 2^-n over poly window, well, we showed that it doesn't matter. That it's sort of an if and only if. But if we want to think about more fine-grained notions of hardness of computing, like to within, you know, 2^-n³ or something, then it really could matter. And this is where Rami's result, I think, is very nice. He can actually prove hardness of the original unitary output, you know, the of computing the output probability of the original unitary circuit, not some approximation. Okay. And so to do this, you know, Rami's gives a new method to interpolate between the worst and random quantum circuit, the worst case and random quantum circuit, using what he calls the Cayley path, which has the advantage of being a new sort of way of drawing a path between two unitaries that stays unitary throughout the entire path. So in other words, he sort of uses all of the techniques that we adapted, except he changes the way we interpolate between the worst case and the average case quantum circuit. And the nice thing about this new path is that unlike our path, which deviates slightly from the unitary group, this stays unitary everywhere throughout the path. And so that's sort of a nice contribution that was a follow-up work of our original paper. Okay. Great. So now I told you in our new paper, where our focus is on sort of are improving the robustness to imprecision here. Right. So remember, I claimed that our a new result is that it's sharp p hard to output an estimate to this output probability p0 of c to within imprecision 2^-m log m, where m, remember, is the size, the number of gates in the circuit. Okay. So let me just, this is sort of a technical proof, and I won't prove it, but I'll sort of give you the statement of the main lemma, which allows us to prove this result, sort of shows you where this m log m comes in. Just the following, so here's what we show. Suppose we're given, so we formalize this as sort of an algorithm. The algorithm is given as input the following information. It's giving on the order of m squared noisy evaluation points to a polynomial, the single variable theta of degree m, okay, where we're guaranteed that these theta I are equally spaced in this tiny subinterval of the unit interval, which I'll call 0 beta. You can think of beta as like 1 over m, the degree. And we know that at least 2/3, some constant fraction of these yi, these points, are delta close to the polynomial. Okay, so in other words, you know, graphically, it looks something like this. If this black curve is q of theta, right, you know, we're not given that as input. Instead, what we're given as input are these sort of red points, which are sort of noisy evaluation points to this polynomial, right? And we're guaranteed that most of them are, you know, to sort of hug this curve, right? But some of them are wildly off, okay? And then what we're asked is, we're asked to find an, we give an algorithm that outputs Z, which approximates the evaluation of this polynomial Q way out here at 1, To within imprecision delta times 2 to the big O of m log beta inverse. Okay, so notice that if we think of beta as being 1 over m, that gives us our 2 to the m log m in the exponent here. And so the sort of the upshot is that if delta is small enough, right, if our point, if the sort of the good points are sufficiently close to the polynomial, like on the order of, you know, it's like say 1 over 2 to the m log m, then we can use these noisy evaluation points, which sort of correspond, as we saw before, to the output probability of random quantum circuits, to estimate q of 1, which is sharp p hard, right? Remember, q of 1 is supposed to encode the output probability of our worst case quantum circuit, which is a hard problem. Okay. So I can say a little bit more about this if we like, but maybe I'd like to just get questions at the moment if the sort of the lemma makes sense. One thing I'll say is that the improvement here is all in terms of beta, this beta parameter. So the prior sort of best way of, best algorithm sort of had essentially a linear dependence on beta inverse in the exponent, and we improve it to log beta inverse. So that's actually where we're getting our big advantage here. Beta, again, being this sort of tiny subinterval of 0, 1 that our sort of random points are taken over. Cool. Any questions before I go on? I'm sort of running out of time, so I do want to say a few more things. So, but maybe one, if there's one question, I'm happy to take it. Okay, great. So let me move on and can ask questions at the end. So far, you know, we've been talking about sort of imprecision, but I would argue not explicitly about noise, right? Not noise in sort of a physical sense. And so it's sort of a problem because we know in these sort of near-term experiments that are, you know, not using any sort of error correction techniques, you know, noise will eventually overwhelm the signal, right? And if you're sort of not convinced of this, you know, you can see that, for example, in Google's experiment, they declared that they had something on, something like 0.2% fidelity on their sort of 53-qubit experiment and 99.8% noise. And of course, there's every indication that as you sort of made the system size larger, the fidelity would decrease dramatically. And so, you know, one interesting question is how can we model this sort of uncorrected noise sort of theoretically in the context of these random circuit sampling experiments? And so one way to do it, which we've been thinking about recently, is by sort of fixing the sort of error model, the noise model. So, you know, one thing we can do is think about the following noise model in which each ideal random two-qubit gate, CI, is followed by a two-qubit depolarizing noise channel of a certain noise strength, gamma. Okay, so this is just the two-qubit noise, depolarizing noise, and gamma is what I'm going to call the noise strength, right? And that is, you know, one way we can think about choosing a noisy random circuit is by first sort of picking the ideal gates in the circuit from the random circuit distribution. So each of these gates are chosen, randomly, just as before. And then the environment, or someone is not sort of not up to us, gets to choose the sort of noise operators from a distribution that's specified by these noise channels, right? So in the case of depolarizing noise, these are these sort of two-qubit poly operators and so on, right? And so then at the end of the day, when we get a sample, when we measure from this random quantum circuit, what we get is a sample from the output distribution of the joint circuit, which I'm calling n dot c. Dot here is gatewise multiplication of the noise operators by the, you know, random gates, without ever learning what the noise operators are. Okay, so that's sort of the model we're going to be considering. And sort of the point I want to get across is that it's, you know, by sort of linearity, we can write the output probability of this noisy quantum circuit as sort of an expectation over the choice of noise operators of the output probability, P0 of this joint circuit n dot c. Okay, so it's not hard to see that the output probability of this noisy quantum circuit can be written as this expectation value over the choice of noise operators. And the point, which is also not hard to see, is that this expectation value, you know, can be written as a weighted sum of Feynman path integrals, right? I'm just writing out what this expectation value is. And the key point, which again, I think is hardly a surprise, is that this is still a polynomial of degree 2m in the ideal gate entries, right? We sort of, you know, we changed what the probability was, but we didn't change the structure that we used in the prior proof, which is that fundamentally this was a degree 2m polynomial in the ideal gate entries of the circuit. And so, you know, by the same arguments as before, we can show a worst average case reduction for computing the output probability of these noisy quantum circuits within exactly the same imprecision, namely plus or minus 2 to the m log m. Okay, cool. So questions before I go on? No, sorry, I have one more bullet point and then I'll ask for questions. I got ahead of myself. So this is just a worst average case reduction with respect to C, right? So of course you should ask, well, how hard is computing the output probability of this noisy quantum circuit if we average over the noise operators, but our C is not random but fixed? Right, and it turns out that a prior result of Fuji dating back to 2016 has shown that this new quantity, where the circuit is worst case, but we're still talking about noise, is also hard to compute if the noise rate is a sufficiently small constant. Okay, so the constant is a constant because it doesn't depend on the system size, but it does depend on sort of the circuit architecture that we're considering. Okay. Cool. So sorry. So questions about this? I have like one or two more slides.
Yeah. Sorry, Bill. I'm just a little bit confused about the fact that you don't know what the noise is. So what does that tell you about the hardness? Because you can't really recover the worst case.
No, actually. So good. So you're absolutely right. In our argument, you never really know what the noise is. The important thing is that you have this polynomial structure, and our argument says however hard the worst case is, it's the same difficulty as the average case. But this result by Fuji actually involves, you know, error detection and actually finding out what the noise, you know, correcting the noise in a certain restricted sense. And so fundamentally, you do end up sort of discovering something about the noise to show the worst case hardness, right? But, you know, for the purposes of the argument I just sketched, you don't have to worry about that. I'm trying to take Fuji's result as sort of a black box that says that in principle, Fuji showed that, you know, this quantity where we have this sort of unheralded noise, you know, this it is hard in the worst case over the quantum circuit. And our result just takes that and, you know, again, fairly simply boosts that to an average case statement. Right. And if I have more time, I'm happy to tell you a little bit more about how Fuji's result works. I didn't include it here because it's not my result, but I'd be happy to talk about that if you have more questions in the end. Okay, cool. So I guess, from my perspective, this result is interesting for a number of reasons. The first is because maybe it gives some intuition that there's sort of, even with uncorrected noise, you know, in sort of a reasonable noise setting where you have depolarizing noise and it can be generalized to, in fact, many different sort of noise models, that you have hardness. But also, I think there's a really important issue here, which is that there's a trivial algorithm for this noisy quantum circuit. So what have we done? Well, we've established that computing the output probabilities of noisy random quantum circuits of size m, which is like n times d, is hard to within precision 2 to the minus m log m, right? But the issue is that, you know, uncorrected depolarizing noise causes the output distribution to rapidly converge to, you know, to the uniform distribution or the maximally mixed state, right, as the system size grows. And this is not surprising, right? I mean, intuitively, I think what's happening is, you know, every time you apply your gates and you have some uncorrected noise, you're sort of adding entropy to your distribution. And if you sort of keep doing that again and again and again after many layers, you know, you're clearly converging to the sort of fixed point, to the uniform distribution. And you know, it's clearly not hard to output a probability from the uniform distribution. I mean, as I say in all my talks, you know, even I can do this, right? The answer is 2 to the minus n. And so the really important question is sort of how fast is this convergence, right? And here we have to be honest, we don't know. So this is something we've been thinking about a lot. But Google did a lot of sort of numerics for their random quantum circuits. And what they concluded numerically, so it's a conjecture, it's not known, is that they think that after you know, sort of d layers, if you have a circuit of size m equal n times d, the output distribution of the noisy quantum circuit is 2 to the minus big O of m close, okay? So this big O is hiding things like the noise strength, right? It's like, it's really, if the noise strength is gamma, the convergence, they conjecture is something like 2 to the minus gamma times m. And in fact, we study this in our paper, and we can prove this convergence in certain simplified toy models. But the point is that this is true, right? If, you know, after we look at the output distribution of our noisy quantum circuit, it's within 2 to the minus m total variation distance to the uniform distribution, then our result, our hardness result, is essentially tight in this setting, right? We're showing hardness for 2 to the minus m log m, and we have a trivial algorithm that just outputs 2 to the minus n, right? So the uniform probability, that works to within precision 2 to the minus m. Right. So if this is indeed the case, which again we're investigating, but Google believes because of a lot of numerics that they did, then in fact our result is essentially tight with respect to the exponent here, you know, within a log factor in the exponent. Okay. Let me just conclude, then you can ask questions. So what have we shown? Well, we've shown that it's hard to compute the output probability of a random quantum circuit to within precision 2 to the minus m log m, which for constant depth, you know, since m is equal to n times d, if d is a constant, that's like 2 to the minus n log n. Whereas to prove hardness of sampling, what we want is actually independent of the depth. We want 2 to the minus n, because that's the size of the typical output probability of a random circuit. But our proof techniques work just as well in the noisy setting, where we think that 2 to the minus m is easy because of the convergence to uniformity. And so the upshot, which I think is actually quite interesting, is that if we want to improve our techniques, improve our results, right, to show the hardness of sampling, we actually need to come up with proof techniques that do not prove hardness in the presence of noise. Right, which is actually a little bit strange. You know, the point is that we know for the noisy case, this hardness essentially can't be improved, right? And so if we want to take the noiseless case and improve that result, we have to come up with a technique that does not work in the noisy case. So this is sort of saying that if we want to improve our techniques, if we want to improve our results to sort of higher imprecisions, like the imprecision needed to show hardness of sampling, we'll actually need to come up with techniques that are very different from the ones we have currently. Okay. So that's all I have. Seems difficult. Okay, thanks.
Okay, let's all thank Bill for that really interesting talk. Do we have any questions?
I'll ask, is it possible, what do you think about the possibility that it's actually not sharply hard at the level that we made the 2 to the minus n?
Yeah, you mean, what do I think that the conjecture might be false? You know, I before this result, I sort of thought that the answer might be yes, with, you know, with say 60% likelihood or something like that. But I think after this result, I think even though formally, I think maybe extending it might be very difficult. I think I would be sort of informally, at least, surprised if somehow you couldn't, you know, that there was really a true barrier to extending to 2 to the minus n. So I guess my first inclination is to think that it probably is true. In fact, we can get quite close, as I said before, but that it might be very, very difficult to do it. You know, at least for boson sampling, like I said, we end up being within a factor of 6 in the exponent of what we need. I mean, if you really think the hardness proof of boson sampling is false, the hardness conjecture is false, then you think that there's something pretty special about that 6. I would find that a little funny, but you know, it wouldn't be the first time that there are sort of constants that end up being sort of more important than we think.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe I'll ask a quick question. So could you say a bit more about this Fuji thing about
the worst
case, but with the noise and how big can noise, the noise be?
Yeah, good. But let me see if I can go back so I can at least have the statement. Okay, hold on. Yeah, so let me try to summarize how Fuji's result works. I didn't do that because I was sort of trying to finish the talk, but it's interesting to see. So I'll try to summarize it. So how do you show these sort of worst case hardness of sampling results? Well, there's actually many ways, but the way I want to think about it now is it turns out by a method that was introduced by Bremner, Joza, and Shepard, it suffices to show universality under post-selection. Right. So in other words, you take this noisy quantum circuit, you sort of supplement it with the ability to post-select, which I mean, inefficiently post-select. So like literally like condition on the outcome distribution of, condition on seeing some exponentially unlikely measurement outcome. And you show that that's universal. So in other words, in complexity theory language, you take post-noisy QP, if you will, and you show that's equal to post-BQP. And that suffices to show the hardness of sampling. And so the idea that Fuji had is something like this. Let's say that you take your noisy quantum circuit and you error detect nearly perfectly, right? So you sort of encode your qubits and so on. And then at the end of the day, you post-select on the outcome of your sort of syndrome measurement, saying that no error occurred. Right. Well, that happens, with a very small probability. But the point is, if you can error detect, you sort of know when it happens. Right. You have a particular outcome that if you see it, it says, you're sure that no error occurred and the output distribution is close to what it should be. And so Fuji's argument, quite simply, is just that if you can do that, if you can error detect, you can show hardness of worst case sampling. And so fundamentally this noise rate is essentially the error detection threshold of whatever code you choose, which of course, like I said before, depends on your architecture, it depends on a whole manner of things, but it doesn't depend on the number of qubits or whatever, which is why I called it a constant. Okay, cool. Does that sort of make sense?
Great. Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you. Do we have any more questions?
Maybe I could ask a question about this noisy setting. So, presumably at large enough noise rate, it becomes easy to sample, I guess, even for like finite depth circuit. So is there like some sharp transition between the complexity of sampling as you tune the noise rate?
Yeah, right. So let me address that question in a number of ways. It's a bit of a loaded question, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. It becomes easy to sample if what you mean by sample is approximately sample. Why does it become easy to sample? Because it's converging exponentially quickly to the uniform distribution. And if you can sample from the uniform distribution, which is not hard, as I've said many times, like you can then sample from a distribution that's exponentially close to that distribution. So what we were talking about here was not sampling, but rather computing computing an output probability of the noisy quantum circuit to within a precision that somehow always beats, it's always faster than the convergence to uniform, right? So in other words, from the perspective of this sort of noisy argument, I'm trying to say, what if we're sort of not interested in these sort of simple arguments that just say, this becomes very close to maximally mixed, we're going to sample from the maximally mixed state. What if we ask, how hard is computing an output probability to within a precision that's faster then the convergence to uniformity. And that's what we could show is hard here.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you're absolutely right. Like, you know, the sampling is easy, but computing, we can still ask how hard is computing a noisy output probability. And that turns out to be a very non-trivial result. And in fact, we're essentially getting a tight result. Right. And that's what I'm saying later. In other words, we sort of know that if our imprecision was sort of any larger, we may as well just output 2^-n. But then if our imprecision is small, a little smaller, we have this transition where we have hardness.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? I'm happy to sort of address that. It's a very good question.
So if you like fix the circuit depth and you vary the noise rate, does this, I guess you're saying the hardness result is correlated with this precision.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. Okay. Exactly what I'm saying. And the precision itself scales with depth.
Okay, I see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a number of parameters here which are sort of confusing to keep in your head, but I think maybe now it's clearer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
But you're absolutely right in that I think we're getting very close to showing sort of a sharp transition in terms of the precision of computing a noisy output probability, which is actually another way of saying everything that I said toward the end.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, unless there are any more questions, let's thank Bill once again for a really fantastic talk.
Thank you.